Good afternoon. My name is David St. John, and I'd like to welcome you to today's panel. The Darkening Trapeze, Last Poems by Larry Levis. And what I'd like to do is to begin by introducing today's panelists. But for the sake of time, I thought I would do something a little different, and I thought I would introduce them all at once. And so, collectively, today's panelists have published more than 25 collections of poetry and translations of poetry, 3 memoirs, 5 books of criticism and essays. They've edited landmark anthologies. Their poetry's been translated into more than 20 languages. They've won international prizes like the T.S. Eliot Prize and the Hiroshima Foundation Award for Peace and Culture. Also, they've won the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, the Yale Younger Poets Prize, the James Laughlin Prize, the American Academy of Arts and Letters Award in Literature, the Kingsley Tufts Prize, the Distinguished Academy of American Poets Fellowship, and even more fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Guggenheim Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Mellon Foundation, the Lyle Wallace Foundation, the Bolyasco Foundation, the Poetry Society of America, and the National Humanities Center. They hold name chairs and distinguished university professorships, and they're the directors of famous writing programs and centers for poetics and social practice, and they're chancellors of the Academy of American Poets, and they're members of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. But of course, we all know none of that really matters. What really matters is what I think. And let me tell you what I think. From their very first books, these 3 remarkable poets have changed the landscape of American poetry. They have enlarged the scope of the political, social, imaginative, formal, and lyric concerns of American poetry. For more than 40 years, these 3 poets have been considered among the most accomplished, innovative, and distinguished poets of their generation. But now, looking back with the perspective we need, we can see that they and their poems now insist that we recognize that they are 3 of the most compelling, crucial, and essential poets of the last part of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century. It's my great honor to introduce Carolyn Forché, Linda Gregerson, and Mark Doty. And now, please let me thank some of the people here today who helped to bring the Darkening Trapeze into the world. First and foremost, Larry Levis's sister, Sheila Brady. Larry's dear friends and colleagues at Virginia Commonwealth University, the poet and editor Gregory Donovan, and the wonderful editor Larry Glenn. And I don't know if they're here, but there are 2 marvelous young poets who helped me assemble and copy edit the manuscript, Amelia Phillips and Gregory Kimbrell. And lastly, I have to thank Grey Wolf Press, and in particular, Jeff Schatz, who's here, who accepted the book I'm not kidding, in less than 24 hours. I know many of you here were at yesterday's sneak peek panel and saw the first half an hour of Michelle Poulos's remarkable documentary on Larry Gold, A Late Saturday Night. And I'm not going to repeat the things I said yesterday about the making or the editing of The Darkening Trapeze, because that story is told in great detail in the afterword of the book. But instead, I've asked the panelists today to talk about Larry Levis's poems and about what Larry's work has meant to them, both in the past and their own lives as poets, and also how this book and these newly published poems have made them think anew about his work and his place in American poetry. And first will be Linda Gregerson, then Karen Forche, and then Mark Hood.
Thank you, David. That was an extremely generous and daunting introduction. Extremely generous. I am honored beyond belief at being invited to speak, at being invited to share a podium with three poets whom I worship just this side idolatry, and who are both lyric and moral examples to me. I am so eager, for those of you who don't know this book yet, to know it and take it to heart. There are varieties of tribute to the dearly missed and essential and beloved departed. Very often, posthumous books bear traces of brokenness. They are not what they might have been had the author survived. This book is a triumph. It's revelatory. When I first read it in manuscript, I felt as though the scales had dropped from my eyes. It returned me to a body of work that is formidable, that is large in its spirit, large, enormously large in its capture of this hard-pressed country we love and are ashamed of. It is technically a kind of handbook. It's quite, quite extraordinary, and it's whole. It is a real book and tribute to the extraordinary work, the selfless and extraordinary work of David St. John. So a little while ago, some of us engaged in what we call a conversation about The Darkening Trapeze, which these days, of course, means varieties of email. Put together to sound as though we were in one another's presence. It's just come out in APR, and I hope some of you have seen it and will go to it. Tony Hoagland, who was meant to be here and whom we miss very much today, and trust to see again soon, was, as always, in every setting, an essential and insightful voice in this conversation. And he said something that seemed brilliant to me, and that I've been thinking about ever since. He talked about Terence Hayes and Tony and I and Greg were trying to, under Greg's persistent and very patient urging, were trying to think with some coherence about the shape of Larry Levis's body of work. And at one point, Tony ventured the following. He said, I think what we see in this passage from the early books to the later books is the transition from the technology of the image to the technology of the sentence. Transition from the technology of the image to the technology of the sentence. The basic unit of apprehension, at least I think what Tony meant by this, is something like the following. The basic unit of apprehension in the early poems is the image, and particularly the isolate image. And it's primarily, often its sole mode of relation is juxtaposition, which often feels like non sequitur. And it's extremely interesting to look at the early work historically and to remember the vitality of this contribution and what that aesthetics of image and juxtaposition was doing, the sort of incitement it represented to our apprehension. In the later poems, by contrast, the primary unit of apprehension, I would propose, is the sentence. The difference between late Levis and early Levis is syntactical in the broadest sense. It's about the logic of connection. So you can see, I want to call attention to the sentence quite literally as a machine and a form of architecture, but I also want to think about sentence, that way of assembling meaning by means of sequence and relatedness. Sentence in that larger sense also. Technically, and this was part of Tony's point, the athletic exploration of the English, or rather, I realized after I wrote that, the American sentence, its momentums and reversals, its speedings up and slowings down, is central, increasingly central, in the body of Larry Levis's work. But the broader discovery of connection is what I'd like to emphasize here, how one thing follows upon another narratively, tonally, associative, in the pitch of diction and implied context. This discovery of connection is both the musical and the moral fabric of the poems. One feels the thinking mind at work, the disobedient spirit, and the breaking heart. And I hope Carolyn will forgive me if I mentioned something I was saying to her just a few minutes ago. When I was thinking about that, the way connectedness on the most literal syntactical level about, of course, any piece of language has a whole history of understanding the logic of how we imply one another and depend upon one another. When I was thinking about that, I could not help thinking about her own amazing work and realized that, especially, of course, that book that was such an eye-opener to all of us, The Country Between Us, that I was thinking about the deep, deep resonance between not just those poems and these very different poems, but the consonance between the vision of the universe and what it means to be human in those two bodies of work. I want to give you just a few examples from a poem in the Darkening Trapeze called The Necessary Angel. And I'm cheating a little bit here because in some cases I'm putting together more than one sentence, but I think you'll hear what I mean about this logic of connection. So this is just a fragment of section 2 from The Necessary Angel. So the girl, and listen, so the girl, right, so there's already something's connected to something else. So the girl who received a whipping with a birch cane in the schoolroom in front of all the others there, who witnessed in the passing weeks the bruises turn yellow and rose until her flesh resembled the random patterns blooming on late peaches. Peaches and cream is what the others called her, taunting her. Is now the woman who watches dry-eyed above the cramped kitchen sink of a house trailer the way the wind whips the weeds in a vacant lot, the way it blows trash against the chain-link fence along the interstate. She is watching it get darker, the dark seeming to spill out of the dark, out of what is already dark. And another example of that poem. And here you will hear some of that tonic edge of non sequitur returning, but this time it's not simply non sequitur as a method of igniting the image. There is non sequitur here as an object of critique and rage and sorrow. "Buddy, you got no idea how fast it happens," the tail gunner said to no one in particular and flicked the gun sight up with his index finger. A moment later, he turned to a wet rose, blossoming all at once and too large for the glassed-in hothouse turret to explain, the bombardier still telling him a joke over the now quiet, frozen intercom. The next day, they fired on and sank a harmless fishing junk with bleaching sails. This logic of connection, of one thing following another, confirming it with a horrible sense of fate, making the way a life unfolds a ghastly circuit of redundancy and entrapment. And of course, in the paying tribute to those lives, there is also a freeing objection to that dynamic. This logic of connection and what's at stake, what we fail when we fail to make connection, is there even in the much earlier poem with which David St. John chose to begin The Darkening Trapeze. And this is an example of how fine this editorial job is and how of a piece this book is. The poem with which this book begins is called Gossip in the Village. That was not its original title. It used to be called The Fifth Season. And it was written in 1982. We learned that from a note in the back. It was originally part of the manuscript that became Larry Levis's fourth book, Winter Stars. And most of the poems in The Darkening Trapeze were written quite a bit later, if we can even use that phrase, in a life cut so wrongly short, but were written in the last decade of Levis's life, many of them in the last year, even the last months. This one was, again, a good decade, in some instances a decade and a half earlier. And my point is that though you'll hear the method is not identical to that in the poems that dominate this volume, it not only belongs, but it teaches us how to read these other poems. And so, again, the point is, please, as I'm just going to read it, and I'm going to kind of stop there so that you can hear other voices here and we can have time for a conversation, but I'd like you to listen for ligature, the kind of hooks that connect one thing to another. It's a relatively short poem indeed, though it does not appear on the page as 8 and 6. It is a sonnet. It's a 14-line poem. Gossip in the Village. I told no one. The snow came anyway. They weren't even serious about it at first. Then they seemed to say, if nothing happened, snow could say that, and almost perfectly. The village slept in the gunmetal of its evening, and there, through a thin dress once, I touched a body so alive and eager, I thought it must be someone else's soul. And though I was mistaken, and though we parted, and the roads kept thawing between snows and the first spring sun, and it was all like spring, irrevocable. Irony has made me thinner. Someday, weeks from now, I will awake alone. My fate, I will think, will be to have no fate. I will feel suddenly hungry. The morning will be bright and wrong. When I was a young poet, I had the great good fortune of meeting Larry Levis, who was then just enough older that I thought he was much older, and by a great measure wiser, and with characteristic generosity, he took me under wing. And now there are traces of him everywhere in my life, not only in the boxes of letters written in black ink on lined yellow paper, which I have not in the years since his death brought myself to read again, but in my life and work and habits of thought. He became an older brother to me, and in that sense is always near, as he seems now. So bringing myself to speak publicly of his poems for the first time is possible only if I think of it as a tribute rather than any species of critical assessment. What interests me beyond the technical mastery is the sensibility at work within him, the dialectic of memory and imagination, the voicing of consciousness shuttling between the far past and the near past and the far past again, the perception of the self as the other within, protean, mutable, evanescent. His radical sense of ambivalence and perceptual acuity. I began reading him with his first book, Wrecking Crew, shortly after my own first book had just been published. Unfinished Poem, the last of this collection, Wrecking Crew, is longer lined than the others, anaphoric, hinting at what was to come. His signature meditative first-person lyric exploring temporal intervals or openings in which something might appear or happen, as if to the self or another who is there or else absent, a voice traversing consciousness associatively across time, alighting on common objects and decisive moments. Levis's later poems unfold artfully to reveal Chinese boxes yielding further disclosures, a seemingly infinite matryoshka of progressively denser epiphanies. The reader, may have a sense of traveling a great distance, but by the end is elsewhere without awareness of how such arrival occurred. In fact, Levis seems playfully to declare that he is not sure himself, an admission that begins as early as the poems in Wrecking Crew, one called For the Country. You are America, you are nobody, I made you up. To the poem's sensationalism with its confession, I have to admit that I have made all of this up, and it could be wrong to make up anything. The voice is speculative, at home in the subjunctive mood, with an affection for the uncertainties of maybe and perhaps. And while we are here, something else is happening there. And there is a hint of Marquesian inventiveness. A glass of water goes blind from staring upward. He is also at home in the conditional mood that pivots on the word if, as in, and if instead, or and if later. We are in the realm of hypotheticals, irrealis rather than realis, where things seem rather than are. And one can propose to go up to myself at age 20 and press $5 into his hand so he can sleep. The self constructed by Levis disappears from his past, his life, and he's never heard of again. This is a protean self that disrupts narrated identity. So it is possible, he writes, that I am not Levis. This is the voice of one who sees the world more acutely and also through the eyes of others, so that the bucolic vineyards his father cultivated for raisins and table grapes seemed like cages to the Mexicans, who were paid 7 cents a tray for the grapes. To see the vines as cages, one must stand within them with no escape. Yet this poet,
is also able to discern the entrapment of the landowners. The way they always seemed afraid of something and sat so rigidly, even though the land was theirs. If we think in terms of what is most characteristic of Levis, it might be his allegiance to uncertainty, his resistance of solipsism, his always provisional solitude, and as he said himself more than once, the sense of internal exile, of exilic being. Stanley Kunitz once lamented that the meditative lyric often suffers from the poverty of what it is meditating upon. But this is not the case in the poems of Larry Levis, wherein there is no apparent poverty of concerns or of the spirit, of history or imagination. The poems might be ekphrastic on Joseph Kudelka's photographs, the paintings of Caravaggio and Edward Hopper. Historic, Stalin's treatment of the Kulaks, the Nazis in Poland, the murder of Lorca. Philosophical, with meditations upon the nature of consciousness, mortality, being, and time. Or they might simply be distillations of awareness, as Linda just mentioned. An anagnorisis that is the fruit of meditative attention. I would like to share now a story regarding one of his poems. I won't read it. It's a wonderfully long ruminative poem. It's titled Sensationalism, and it is from the collection Winter Stars. The poem is an ekphrastic meditation on a photograph by the Czech photographer Joseph Kudelka. It was actually titled Romania 1968, but Larry Levis frees himself in the first line and tells us there's no title and no date. So now he can do what he wants with his ekphrasis. And in this photograph, a man is shown kneeling before a horse that wears blinders and a blanket, and there is a blank wall behind them. Larry begins by freeing the photograph, as I have said, and then he invents the story that was the occasion of this image. I love this poem and read it often to my students, because I wanted to teach them how to go back and forth in time and memory and place. Years later, I was living in Paris with my husband, who is also a photographer, and Joseph Kudelka had by then become a dear friend, who often happened to stop by just at dinner time and always seemed to know when that would be, even though it was always at different times because we had an infant baby in the house. But he would show up, and you might think that he imagined that Joseph Kudelka, if you look at his images, you think, this is a very dour Central European man. But Joseph Kudelka is happy all the time, okay? And he brings a flask of vodka around with him everywhere. And if you run into him on the street, the first thing he does is pour a shot for each of you, and you have to drink it no matter what time of day it is. So he would come to my house, and sometimes he would tell me, by the way, tonight you are giving a dinner party. I'm having some friends come with me. So you have to go to the store. And so this is how he was. So he liked to clown around. And after dinner, one particular night, I sat him down and I thought, I wonder if this guy has a serious side like his photographs do. So I read him the poem Sensationalism. He listened, got a very serious look on his face. He said, this poet wrote this about my photograph. I said, yes, an American poet. And so Joseph came back the next day with a print he had made of a photograph signed to Larry Levis. He said, I want you to give this to this poet from me. So I brought it to him. Yesterday, when I saw the film Michel Poulz made for the first time, The Late Style of Fire, I saw the photograph hanging on the wall behind him in the film. It was just delightful for me. But we are also asked today to speak about the poems in Darkening Trapeze, the poems that were with him in the quiet, of the period of his death, poems of his late period, some of them his last poems, in which it became possible to say, life has one sad wing and no claws. And later in the same poem, finally, he does not even need the pen or paper. There are surprising moments here. A prose poem on the subject of representation, an epistolary to André Breton, an earlier Ghazal that asks if exile begins at birth, a poem in octets all unmistakably in the key of Levis. While not all of these poems were written toward the end, a good many were, and it is impossible to read them without recognizing a certain pattern of foreboding. The truth is, the whispered shape of his death is too loud to hear. And in another, the line that Linda read, "Buddy, you got no idea how fast it happens." And then there is one of those blind, drunk, or high, or homeless, who would have no alternative except to freeze to death, and whose childhood is no more than a blackened rafter, something left after fire has swept through it. There is the poet's burden, having to imagine everything in detail and without end. Whatever forces conspired toward his death, he saw it coming. And in these poems, he seems to be saying goodbye to himself, his childhood, his friends, his family, his art, and his times. Goodbye, little century. As with the other of his friends, I enter his poems as if through a trapdoor, and we are there again, driving along the coast with all the windows down, walking through a snowy night with blankets over our heads, having run out of cigarettes while reading poems, and he is back. Levis is back, as he seems to be in this book, and the voice is his. Thank you.
School teacher in 1974, and there's a big federally funded child care center, and we got a grant from the State Arts Council to bring a couple poets to teach the preschool teachers something about working with children writing poetry. And poets were David St. John and Larry Levis. Neither of them had yet published a book 40 years ago, and to think. Reading this astonishing final book of poems by Larry Levis, perhaps especially because the book has appeared 20 years after the poet's death in 1996, nearly at the end of the 20th century, I've been thinking about that century's poetics. And though I generalize, as you have to do in order to make a narrative out of any 100 years of art making, it seems to me that a central current in that dazzling period of American poetry must be our long conflicted study of what it means to be a self. 20th century poetry has in turns resisted, obscured, avoided, contemplated, exposed, deified, or atomized the self. Today I want to talk about the darkening trapeze as a kind of terminus of this project. Not that we're done with the conversation, but rather perhaps that one crucial part of that conversation arrives at its endpoint here in this book's gorgeous and desolate accomplishment. It's hard to corral the crazy wealth of American poems written in the century's early years into a singular category. How to account for the chiseled cool of H.D. beside the messy heat of Mina Loy, or the exuberant transcendence of Hart Crane beside William Carlos Williams' spare evocations of broken bottles? What the era's wildly inventive poets seem to have in common is a rejection of the Victorian and Edwardian verse that preceded them, with its formal draperies and socially approved sentiment. For many, to reject sentimentality was to reject all the ways a feeling self might be represented. Couldn't the poem behave more like a machine, or a camera, or a microscope, a device for generating language? By the late 1920s, a modernist position toward the problem of sentimentality, that old claptrap of personal feeling that seemed to have kept poetry mired in the flowery swamp, found its clearest embodiment in an enormously influential essay of T.S. Eliot's Tradition and the Individual Talent, in which the poet famously argued that poetry should be an escape from personality and not an embodiment of it. Never mind that Eliot's own poems are, the best of them, rife with a sense of personality. The particular character of their speaker, just think of the Journey of the Magi, for instance, or Prufrock. Don't you know a great deal about the person you've met reading those poems?
that dry, disappointed man with held, uncertain despairing? Do you believe he's a literary construct? An apparition built of words by the maker's choice? Well, yes, in a way, but nothing is made from nothing, and chosen words are the signature of a self. And I take it as axiomatic that the personality that emerges on the page is neither an accident nor solely the production of the intellect. We write ourselves. The great poets of Eliot's era, Stevens and Moore and Millay among them, wrote poems profoundly distinguishable to one another because their disparate personalities expressed themselves in marriages of style and content that made them unmistakable. But never mind. Just as Freud's followers in America built a Freudianism far more rigid than anything their founder ever conceived, so American poets and critics from the 1930s well into the 60s valorized a poem that was distinct from autobiography, read without reference to the life of the writer or whatever factors had shaped that life. The poem was, in essence, a device made of words, artfully built to accomplish its task. Just how pervasively this point of view permeated literary culture is remarkable. When I was first a student in a poetry workshop about 1970, we gave our poems to the teacher who typed them onto mimeograph sheets so that our individual typewriters wouldn't be discerned or discernible, mimeographed them and distributed them without the writer's names attached. The idea was that we would discuss the poem anonymously, as if it had dropped into the room from space, devoid of intention. This was intended to protect us in a way by making the process objective or neutral, but what it really accomplished was the promotion of a new critical ideal. The poem existed apart from you, and what you might have wanted to say was essentially off the table. In the realm of art, we left the personal behind. But that workshop met, in fact, 20 years after a remarkable generation of American poets had set out in another direction. During the 1950s, Robert Lowell, Elizabeth Bishop, Theodore Retke, John Berryman, and Randall Jarrell began to write a poetry that was autobiographical in its origins, albeit an autobiography shaped, selected, mythologized. The poems allowed us to meet a character, the poet as a consistent speaker from poem to poem, and to follow that character from book to book, bringing our knowledge of that person with us to the poems in each new volume. Bishop's exiles, Lowell's breakdowns and marital struggles, Berryman's horrifically funny internal minstrel shows, these became stages for the poem, as it were, theaters of self-knowledge or inquiry. Now, those last two terms, self-knowledge, inquiry, they're crucial. The search for insight, along with consummate craft, prevents these poems from being mere acts of display. The critic M.L. Rosenthal coined what would prove to be a pernicious term, confessional poetry, in response to Lowell's groundbreaking 1959 book, Life Studies. But the analogy to the sacrament of confession is wrong. These poems are less like admittances made to a priest in search of absolution than they are like monologues to a psychoanalyst spoken in search of insight and understanding. And I underline monologue. These utterances are performed, shaped for their audience. Lowell said in an interview, "I want the reader to feel that he's getting to know the real Robert Lowell." A quote which pretty much says it all. The authentic here has been constructed as any poem is, the self preferred there both inevitably real and partial. From the vantage point of 2016, this poetic project seems part and parcel of a large-scale American cultural project, the reinvestigation of and refiguring of what once seemed unquestionable, the centrality of a normative white heterosexual family with its sane, stable, and powerful men, its sane, yielding, and nurturing women. American poetry was in the vanguard of a cultural process, a whole-scale reexamination, peeling back layers of assumption, giving the lie to falsehood, inquiring into the foundations. One strand of American poetry dissects and offers alternatives to patriarchy, sexism, racism, and homophobia. Another took the dominance of a limiting rationality as a means through which intuition and the inner life are suppressed, took as its rallying point the fiery life of deep imagery. The method and style are different indeed, but the aim is at least in one way the same, to bring to light through the vital agency of the poem those aspects of self we have cast into shadow. There were many permutations of this arc. When I was coming into my own as a poet in the 1980s, there was a vogue for what we call the memory narrative, a poem that used incidents and images from the past to reach toward meaning, to account for psychic and cultural conditions in the present. Its practitioners included David Wojahn, Linda Hull, Mark Jarman, and Larry Levis. It was already an unstable category with much latitude. Herbert Morris comprised magnificent blank verse meditations on the nature of memory and syntax straight from Henry James. David St. John's indelible lyrics were so centered on the emotive and revelatory power of the image that they resist being narratives at all. Lynn Emanuel's heady constructions already insisted on the self as fictive, a dream, compounded of language and time. And of course, there were significant counters. New formalism decried a dominant emphasis on content and advocated for the musical, distancing powers of form. Language poetry in the 90s applied post-structuralist theory and deemed the signifying power of words uncontrollable, and poetry a game system in which, rather as in the days of those old mimeographed handouts, intention was shown to be a false and paltry thing. There's the 20th century. Turning to the final collection, from one of the major poets of that century's last years in this light, what might be disturbing? Levis began under the star of the deep image, that neo-surrealist movement that held as its central principle the power of the poetic image to communicate directly from the unconscious of the writer to the inner life of the reader. When James Wright said, "My bones turn to dark emerald in the wind," you just supposed to know what that means. You do, right? That's the way it works. They didn't want any pesky interference by the intellect. They're supposed to go from channel to channel, interruption. Like all great poets, Levis absorbed influences contrary to the period style. He practiced it, but he soaked up other stuff, ones which complicate and enlarge his poems, which over the years grew more meditative, more interested in history, in the ways in which art sustains our humanity or remembers our presence, and, of course, in what of human tenderness or spirit might survive in the face of the coruscating winds set blowing in our direction by the angel of history. Now, as he moves forward, particularly into the poems in this book, his repeated gesture is to inscribe a character of perception, a way of seeing, that could be no one else's way of seeing, and then promptly to declare that the self which sees that, which speaks that way, is vanishing, is disappearing, is no longer there. It's an act of continually asserting oneself and erasing oneself over and over again. What survives in the face of the winds blowing in our direction? The ultimate answer, Levis's readers will attest, is not much. From the first posthumous volume, Magnificent Elegy, he sees the world as an ossuary of horses, an ossuary of bone marrow. This world, one vast cemetery of horses. But the speaker who's doomed to lose every bet will stand at the racetrack and claim the hopeless world as his anyway. By the last trapeze, time's powers have done their worst. The speaker doesn't have the will to claim much of anything. This is a self battered and diminished by a knowledge of what power comes to, by disappointment in the possibility of human connection, by the intellectual prospect of death, by the physical and cultural prospect of American towns. To stare at Kmart for 3 hours is to feel myself rapidly aging, not Kmart, he says. By most lights, then, this book ought to be profoundly depressing, a desolate text of failure, one to be avoided. It is anything but that, although it is desolate. Any honest account of the human position now must make room for desolation. I want to offer two quotations as a means of suggesting how a book like this can rise up out of its own darkness. The first is from Julia Kristeva, from her book Black Sun on Depression and Melancholia. Naming suffering, she writes, exalting it, dissecting it into its smallest components, that is doubtless a way to curb mourning. Naming suffering, dissecting it into its smallest components, that is doubtless a way to curb mourning. I know it's true that saying what one feels carefully, accurately, even obsessively, accomplishes something for the writer. It does not dispel suffering, but it does indeed curb it. But we might consider what such efforts do for the reader. What happens for us when suffering is exalted by superbly rendered language, by the enlivening energy of precision? What takes place in us when poetry's power to lift is applied to the body which is plummeting downward? Just a few weeks ago, for the first time in my life, I went to Andalusia, at least in part to search for what I might find of Federico Garcia Lorca. It was Santa Semana, Holy Week in Granada. And at night, the narrow streets filled with processions, each guild carrying some potent image through the streets on a trono, a float, a virgin or a risen Christ, or centurions meeting out pain. Behind each trono came a marching band, their music so Spanish and strange that I had never heard anything like it. A marching tune would bend somehow into an almost grating blare of horns that suddenly seemed to cry out sheer hurt. And then from that would come in turn a sort of elevation, an enlargement of the song which did not erase grief, but simply lent it nobility. I am this grief. I wear it. I would not be myself without it. I have no choice, but I will wear it as if I did. Wear it through the streets, 10, 100 feet tall. And the dark but soaring music of many bands collided, one parade crashing into another, and they made in the night air over Granada one broken and triumphant thing. And here is Levis himself, from an essay called Notes on the Gazer Within. "I find I've been speaking all along about nature, about the attempt of the imagination to inhabit nature, and by that act preserve itself for as long as it possibly can against the pressure of reality. That phrase, of course, the pressure of reality, belongs to Wallace Stevens, who is the angel who haunts this book. Stevens believed the imagination might be our bulwark against the depredations of the real. And that's where we find Levis at Century's End, an acolyte of art who knows that imagination will save him from nothing. The moment of writing, Levis writes, is not an escape. It is only an insistence through the imagination upon human ecstasy, and a reminder that such ecstasy remains as a birthright in this world as much as misery remains a condition of it. That is the secret of this book. The self-media fiction, constructed by the imagination as a refuge against time, may be an unchartable wilderness, may be the sum of every gesture we hold dear, doomed to be erased, may never have been here at all, may be a moment that's suddenly blown across the threshold like a swirl of snow, but our consciousness of our own erasure, our ability to name it with all the painful exactitude we can muster, these unforgettable poems assert, even that is beautiful. Wow.
I'm going to read one final poem. It would be hard to exaggerate how fragile we feel talking about Larry. So let me end with what might be the final poem that he ever wrote. And it's called God is Always 17. This is the last poem in the book. In a way, I don't even want to finish it. I'd rather go to bed and jack off under the covers, but I'd probably lose interest in it and begin wondering about God and whether he's tried the methamphetamine I sent him. And if he still listens to The Clash, and whether the new job he got for Mozart as a janitorial assistant in Tulsa is working out. Besides, I can't imagine a body in the first faint stirrings of arousal without feeling sorry for it now. And anyway, I've built a fire in the fireplace, and I don't have a fire screen yet, and have to watch it until it goes out, even the last lukewarm ember. It isn't my house. It belongs to a bank in St. Louis somewhere, and they have 4,000 different ways to punish me if the place goes up in flames. Including the guys from Medellin who work for them now and specialize in pain. Besides, it's still winter everywhere, and maybe you want to hear a story with a fire burning quietly beside it. The story on this night when it got really cold, and the darkness of the night spreading over the sky seemed larger than it should have been, though nobody mentioned it. It was something you didn't feel like bringing up. If you were sitting in a bar there among friends. But all that happened was the night kept getting larger, then larger still. And then there was a squeal of brakes outside the bar, and then what they call in prose a sickening crunch of metal as two cars collided. And in a little while, the guy went back to telling this story in which the warm snow was falling on the yard where he and the other prisoners were exercising. I guess the guy had evidently done some time, though everyone listening was too polite to bring it up. And what happened in it was a clerk bleeding to death in a 7-Eleven, and the guy telling it called 911 for an ambulance, and the police found both cash from the till and the gun on him when they arrived. He didn't think he'd shot anyone that night or anyone else, and was surprised and puzzled when they made a match on the gun. The clerk lived to testify, and they convicted him. No one along the bar said anything when he finished telling it, and the night went on enlarging in the story. And I think our silence cut him loose and let him go, falling. And one by one, we paid and got up and left and went out under the stars. I have a child who isn't doing well in school. It's not his grades, it's that he can't wake up. He misses his morning classes and doesn't answer when I call and doesn't return my calls. The last time I saw him, we took the train down from Connecticut to New York and wandered around Times Square. We went into this record store and pretended to browse through some albums there, because we didn't know what to say to each other. It was night. It was just before the Christmas season. And no clerks in the store would call out loudly, "Can I help anybody? And can I help someone?" And there was some music playing and something inconsolable and no longer even bitter in the melody. And I will never forget being there with him and hearing it and wondering what was going to become of us.
Thank you.